It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The U.S. Department of Justice has decided to do away with a longstanding policy that forbids federal agents from recording statements made by criminal suspects in their custody. Now, law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, DEA, and ATF, will electronically record interrogations of people in custody. Some of these agencies have been resistant to this change. So what could this mean for the future of law enforcement? I'm joined now by Pitt Law Professor David Harris. David, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's good to be with you again.
What does the Department of Justice decision do?
What it does is it sets policy for all of the federal law enforcement agencies. So the big ones are the FBI, the DEA, ATF, federal marshals. There are a handful of other smaller ones as well. What it says is that the longstanding policy against recording interviews of suspects is now lifted and changed in favor of a, quote, presumption that all of those interviews with suspects in any place of detention will be recorded. There are a few exceptions, but the presumption is there to be recorded. And that is a huge shift. I cannot overemphasize how big a change that is. And it was in the face of lots of change on this issue in local and state law enforcement across the country. We have states now that have been recording interrogations for 20 and more years. The experience of other agencies has been almost uniformly positive, and it was always the FBI that was lagging behind.
As you mentioned, this is a major shift. So what brought it about?
Well, I think, you just get to a tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell so terrifically said a few years ago with his book. You get to a point where the evidence builds up, the experience builds up, and frankly, jurors were beginning to expect it. They're just the same way that there is an expectation of more forensic testing, for better or for worse. There is now an expectation building up in courts that, why didn't you record it? If there's a dispute about what happened, about whether the Miranda rights were given or whether the person was forced to make the statement, why don't we have a recording? Because everybody knows that recording equipment, cameras and audio, is ubiquitous. When I go and I talk about this, when I talk about my book, Failed Evidence, or I do police training, I ask everybody in the audience, how many of you are carrying right now on your person a fully equipped audio and video recording system? And 3/4 of the hands go up because people have smartphones. So it's no longer tenable to argue that it's too expensive, that the equipment is too hard to get. I don't mean that they should make smartphone recordings. I'm simply saying that this has become a kind of expectation in society. And I think the FBI saw that they were simply on the wrong side of history here. They needed to catch up. And I hope they also realize that it would generally help them, not hurt them.
Well, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona Mel McDonald, who is now a defense attorney, was quoted in a Huffington Post piece saying it was a no-brainer to reverse what he described as an insane policy. How do you see it?
I thought the choice of words was interesting. Within federal law enforcement, it has been received wisdom for a long time, and it has even been policy that recording would be a bad thing and was against the rules. And the hesitation there was that if suspects were recorded, they would clam up and they wouldn't talk. And it would change the equation for trying to interview people, and juries would be suspicious of many of the tactics that agents use to interrogate people that are legal, but the juries wouldn't like them.
They also be suspicious if something isn't recorded and a suspect or a defendant is saying, I confessed, but they beat it out of me?
Yeah, well, and I think that's the kind of thing that changed the equation. Not even necessarily beat it out of me, but people want to see evidence. They don't just want recollections. They know there's a better way. And I think what Mr. McDonald was saying was, once you've tried doing this, once you've used recordings in court, It's crazy to resist it because it, generally speaking, improves law enforcement effectiveness. It's very good in front of juries. There really is nothing to fear. So from his point of view, it was nuts to hold out against it. But that was sort of received dogma within a lot of law enforcement, but especially the federal agencies.
And what I was referring to earlier was the idea that, for example, someone who's being interrogated, if they were not provided with an attorney, and they may have requested one during the course of the interrogation. I'm not going to talk to you until I get a lawyer. And maybe the people that were interrogating him proceeded with the interrogation and did not honor the request
right.
for an attorney to be present, and there would be no record of that. So I guess abuses could be prevented here because
yes,
of recording.
Absolutely. And that's one of the best things about it. I think to the extent that there was either abuse or maybe something very close to abuse, something very close to the legal lines that are in place, those things will be rooted out. There will be a record. So it won't be possible anymore to deny what happened. Now, in many instances, I think you have to honestly say that when there was conflict within the interrogation room, when something happened like you just said, Paul, like a request for an attorney and maybe they, you know, there's an attempt to talk the person out of that. Sure, we can get you a lawyer, but, you know.
But first, let's talk,
you know, think of it this way.
First, go ahead and incriminate yourself. And
perhaps.
Then we'll get you the lawyer.
Usually it's a lot more subtle, but yes. That may have been over the line just a little bit or even a lot. And in a situation like that, if it's recorded, there's going to be no dispute anymore. The memo from the Attorney General says the entire interview from the time that the person comes into the interrogation room to the time the interview is concluded, the whole thing has to be recorded. It's not good enough to simply record the confession at the end. We have to see what leads up to it. And this will, like it or not, and I'm not imputing anybody's integrity, this will raise the practice and the standard. It will weed out some of those techniques because of the fact that there's a record. You will also get benefits not just to the defense in that respect and to the defendant, but to law enforcement. Law enforcement will be able to know that the entire thing is being recorded, so they won't have to constantly duck down into papers and take notes. They'll get more guilty pleas. That's been the experience of law enforcement agencies when they record because there's just no dispute about little things or big things like whether somebody got Miranda warnings. It's there. People can see it. There's no dispute. So court time is reduced. More guilty pleas. There are great advantages in terms of being able to go back and look at the interview again because you're a professional interviewer. You probably have listened to your own interviews and said to yourself, God, I hadn't realized what a great moment that was or I forgot something or something like
sure.
that. When you have a recording, you can go back and listen in a way that you just can't when all you're doing is taking your own notes or having a written statement.
Well, I think anybody who's ever gone back and listened to a recording that they were involved in, there are probably 50% of the time you don't remember things exactly the way they happen, and there it is on tape. And it is a revelation a lot of times when you
Absolutely.
Go back and check it out. Now, law enforcement agencies do this and have done it for a while. So why did the federal agencies, particularly the FBI, resist doing this for so long? You said you were that the primary concern was that the person being interrogated would clam up.
Yes.
Was there some other thing that they were concerned
about?
Well,
that was the primary concern. Even though with 20 years of experience in Minnesota, in Alaska, and a number of other places, it just did not prove out. There was no evidence of that anywhere that there have been recording rules, it just doesn't happen. And you know, you put that recorder down in front of somebody or you flip it on, and pretty much it's forgotten in the first 5 minutes. And the FBI rule here, the new memo, even allows recording to take place covertly. You don't even have to have the recorder out. You don't even have to tell the person. You just have to do it. Other reasons, though, were really more cultural than anything else. Law enforcement generally has a strong culture, and each agency has a culture of its own. And the culture of the FBI has simply been, apart from their rules, we think there's an advantage to us in not recording what goes on and in simply writing it down, because if there's any dispute, we're going to go to court, and who is the jury going to believe? Who's the judge going to believe, the FBI agent or this defendant who's trying to get out of going to jail, who's trying to get a statement suppressed? Now we have a record. It's got to be done right. It's all got to be there, and there is no dispute about the basic facts.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. We're discussing the Justice Department decision to do away with a longstanding policy forbidding federal agents from recording statements made by criminal suspects in their custody. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. Again, the number 412-246-2002. Is there anything about past recording interrogations that might have backed up the FBI's fears? You're saying that there isn't any evidence of that at all?
Well, there was no evidence that people clammed up. And frankly, when people say stuff like, well, I'll talk to you, but I won't talk to you with the tape recorder on, both the FBI memo and all the states that use these practices say, that's fine. Go ahead then. Make a record of the fact that the person did not want to be recorded and go ahead and do an interview without it. So there was never any evidence that this prevented interrogations or slowed the process down in any way. There are always fears that the equipment is going to malfunction, that something will go wrong and that's what the case will turn on. And all of these rules, including the new Department of Justice rule, references the fact that you do not need to fear that, because that would be reason to excuse the recording. If something had actually gone wrong, or if the equipment was not available, not working, as long as you could document that, you would still be in good shape. The things that might have backed up the FBI in the past is, in my experience, I look less to the FBI than to the many police departments that have been doing this for quite some time. We have a couple of very good studies done by Tom Sullivan, who's the former United States Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, and he exhaustively cataloged the experiences and practices of many police departments doing this, and they were all very positive. So there's really nothing there except fear, I think, that's holding them back.
If the recorder isn't out or in plain sight, can the defense make an argument that someone is being taped without their knowledge?
Sometimes. Some states. What this federal rule says, promulgated by the Justice Department, is that that's not an issue. The agents are allowed to record covertly. It may be that some states might have a contrary rule. And they're entitled to have that because they can have greater protections for defendants than the FBI rule calls for, or even than the federal constitution calls for. Those things are baseline, and you can always have more protection. You just can't have less than what the constitution calls for.
And the states that have been doing this, you said Minnesota, Alaska?
Minnesota and Alaska have the longest experience with this, especially Minnesota. And what you find when, I've gone up not to Alaska but to Minnesota a number of times for presentations and discussions on this issue and others involving the things in my book, and they are enthusiastic supporters. When I say they, I mean not just the police but prosecutors, of recording interrogations, because they have seen, they have the experience, it doesn't hold them up, it works for them, it really helps. I had a police captain's quote that always sticks in my mind. He says, recording interrogations was the best reform that was ever shoved down our throats. I mean, that really captures it. They didn't want it. It had to be shoved down their throats by their state Supreme Court. But when they had to do it, they figured out pretty quick, this generally works for them.
We're talking about the Justice Department decision to allow recorded statements made by criminal suspects in their custody, allow the recording of those interrogations. We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about this, and you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. We'll continue in a moment. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are discussing the Justice Department decision to do away with the policy of forbidding federal agents from recording statements made by criminal suspects in their custody. Our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Let's go to Buddy in Washington. Buddy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. I have a question and concerning how these videos are to be used in potentially in trial. And so my understanding, and maybe I was misinformed and Mr. Harris could correct me, but my understanding was there's certain rules in how evidence in criminal trials is handled, and they're called chain of custody rules. And maybe I've heard that some courts, in the case of where evidence goes missing during trial, there's certain presumptions where the jury's told to presume that that evidence would have favored the defendant, the person on trial. And my question is, could those kinds of rules be applied in cases where, from in the future here on, the law enforcement agencies decided not to videotape, or there was some sort of mistake, or they claimed that an error happened in videotaping? Could we see certain kinds of chains of evidence rules applied where the jury is instructed that because there wasn't any videotapes of the interrogation, to presume that it would have favored the defendant?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you that the state of Massachusetts, which does record interrogations, they have a rule already just like that, Buddy. Their rule is that if there is no recording, the jury gets told to presume that a recording would have favored the defendant and that they should look at testimony about any unrecorded confession or statement with skepticism. So, and you could imagine states doing this in a lot of different shapes with different nuances. Evidence could be kept out if not recorded. I think that is probably going too far. It's better to do something like what Massachusetts has done, and the courts may evolve a rule like that over time in reaction to some of this new federal policy.
So it really puts the state, the onus on the state and the feds to do everything they can to make sure that that recording is produced.
Absolutely. That's the function of having a jury instruction like that. It puts teeth in the rule, essentially. You're not only responsible to your boss who is enforcing the internal rules, and that's what the Justice Department memo is. It's an internal rule. It's not a law. But the courts, if they do things like use presumptions and use exclusion, they put teeth in those kind of rules.
Let's go to Chris in Ford City. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
My question or comment is the videotaping has been something that has been being pushed for, but I thought it was more on the end of protecting the person that had been arrested or detained because of interrogation techniques that have changed over the last 40 or 50 years where it's almost a nuanced way of coercing people into, you know, confessing to crimes that they haven't done. And there are people that are in prison and incarcerated right now that have confessed to crimes that they never did just because they are basically under duress during that time. And if this is videotaped, then it can show, the techniques which you alluded to earlier as to how they got this person to come to this conclusion that they did something that they did not do. And I'll hang up and listen and see what you have to say about that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
That's a terrific comment and question, Chris. We've talked here mostly about advantages for law enforcement, but you're quite right. The impetus for this has been the abuses that have taken place and the many exonerations that have occurred with DNA, in which we know for certain that while the person confessed, it wasn't that person who did it. We know it because of the DNA. So you look at the 300-plus exonerations that there have been, which are sort of the tip of the iceberg because it's only DNA that's testable and relevant in a small percentage of cases. But you look at those cases and you see 25% feature either a false confession or a false statement of guilt. That's a lot. And so a lot of this comes out of that very thing. And the idea is, if it's recorded, the worst kinds of abuse cannot take place because the jury will see it. One of the FBI's big hesitations, Chris, I have to tell you, and this was in their prior memorandum in 2006, which still forbade recording at that time, their big hesitation is if judges see these recordings and they see what we actually do, they may not like it. And maybe they'll react with a not guilty verdict or a suppression. And that is to say that they're allowed to do a number of things to put pressure on a suspect within very, very indefinite sorts of bounds. The Miranda decision was supposed to take care of a lot of that, but as a person who studied that for years, and there's lots of research out there on this, there is still plenty that detectives and police are allowed to do within the law. They can, for instance, lie. It's allowed. They can lie about scientific evidence. They can say, you failed the polygraph. They can say, we've got your DNA, so we know you were there. You might as well give us a statement or you'll get this very harsh penalty. All that is allowed. And I think what this recording requirement will do is it will rein in the worst of that. Certainly if it was illegal, but even some of the stuff that is legal but really is still coercive.
At the end of the day, who is going to gain from recording requirements, David, in criminal cases, the prosecution or the defense?
I think it's going to be both, Paul. I really do. Certainly for the reasons we just went through with Chris, the defense will gain. People will not be subject to the same kinds of pressures. They will certainly not be subject to the worst kinds of abuse. And at the same time, the prosecution will gain because the record in a good case, in a decent interrogation, will be solid. They'll be able to get it introduced with no problem. The administration of Miranda warnings will be right there. The judge and jury will be able to see it. And so they're going to gain, too. This is one of those reforms where once you put it in place and get people used to it and you make that shift, everybody is going to come out better than they were. It really is that kind of change.
And what have our local jurisdictions in Allegheny County been doing on this issue?
Well, they're a little ahead of the feds here. For some time, District Attorney Steve Zappala has been asking that that Allegheny County law enforcement agencies begin to record their interviews with homicide suspects. And I believe the Pittsburgh Police Department has been doing that. The action now is to try to move that recording encouragement, if not a requirement, into all serious felony cases. Mr. Zappala does not have the power to force these police departments to do that. But when he says, this is what I'm going to expect in my cases, it carries a great deal of weight. So we've started down that path here in Allegheny County. One hopes that the federal actions on this will reinforce it.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us in Studio A. As always, David, great thanks.
My pleasure, Paul. Good to be with you.
Coming up, a conversation with a woman who blazed a trail in television news. We'll talk with the legendary Eleanor Shano. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.